It's not just a game, it's not just a grass. Lawn Solutions Australia is the exclusive home of Australia's best sports turf varieties. For the world's best grasses like Tiff Tough Hybrid Bermuda and Sir Grange Zoysia, contact Lawn Solutions Australia at lawnsolutionsaustralia.com.au. Hello and welcome to episode 102 of The Thing About Golf, though these next couple of episodes might well be tagged The Thing About the Ryder Cup. My colleague John Huggan has been busy in the lead-up these past couple of weeks, nailing down various European players and captains, and this week, I must say, is a real treat. Huggy, firstly, what a delight Graham McDowell was to listen to last week, as you promised us, and I thought that might be a hard act to follow, but in a more understated way, I think this week's guest, Bernard Gallagher, might be every bit as good. He was terrific.
Yeah, well, I've known Bernard a long time. I grew up, he must be about 10 years older than me, I would think. So I grew up watching him play, at the highest level with a game that he would tell you himself was built around an extraordinary ability from inside 100 yards. I mean, he was top three or four in the world from that distance, but he might have been one of the worst drivers at that level. I mean, obviously, driver of the ball, yeah, but not relative to the competition he was playing against. So he managed to build a career on a game that had limitations, obviously. But again, if you took his record in the Ryder Cup, which I touched on in the podcast, I mean, the people that he's beaten head-to-head in Ryder Cup, I mean, Nicklaus, Trevino, major champions, four or five of them, I can't come to mind right now, but his record is extraordinary given what sort of game. But actually, he did have the perfect game for match play. He was annoying.
Yeah, I was just about to say that.
Down a lot.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, exactly the sort of player you don't want to come up against in match play. I was a little bit surprised, I've got to say, Huggy, about how outspoken he was. The passage of time is wonderful for this stuff, isn't it? But we heard some details and bits and pieces of stories that we've probably kind of known a little bit, but we got the inside scoop, which I thought was wonderful.
Yeah, well, he was captain in the Ryder Cup, but he played, I think, seven or eight times, and then was captain three times, 91, 93, 95. And 91, first time, was the famous, war on the shore at Kiawah Island. I think I touched again on this. I don't think he and Dave Stockton are swapping Christmas cards every year. It didn't go well, shall we say, put it that way.
Yeah, indeed. And as he pointed out, in some ways was the beginning of what we now associate with the Ryder Cup far too much, is crowd involvement, boisterous behaviour. And in fact, it goes beyond boisterous, doesn't it? There's been a lack of goodwill and spirit in many of the recent Ryder Cups.
Yeah, I've been to umpteen of them now, and it's getting towards toxic, the atmosphere at some of them. It's not pleasant. It does the game no credit. And the fact that they're going to take it to Bethpage Black in 2025 beggars belief, because that's going to be an absolute zoo. Yeah. It really is.
Yeah, well, we saw what happened to the President's Cup when it went to New York, didn't we? And that was the worst one we've seen. Yeah. There was some awful stuff said to some people there. Back to the Ryder Cup was clearly very important to Bernard, which possibly – part of the era, do you think? Is the Ryder Cup still as important to players as I think you pointed out in the podcast, this toxic nature of the Ryder Cup might soon see some players say, you know what, I don't want to be a part of it.
Well, there is a line, and I think we're getting close to it. I don't think we're at it yet. I mean, nobody's actually come out and said, look, I don't fancy this, I'm not going to play. Why should I stand there and take this abuse? But I think, Bethpage has the potential to be a tipping point.
The line in the sand,
there's no doubt.
Yeah, indeed. What were you surprised by most about Bernard? There was a couple of things I was surprised by, but you're much more familiar with the Ryder Cup than I am. This is my last question for you about the interview. What were some of the revelations that you were surprised by, particularly with Bernard? The vice-captain's role was one that sprung to my mind, and you sounded shocked by that too.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, you're right. The sort of minimal input that he had, or in fact no input whatsoever, when he was technically speaking the assistant captain to Tony Jacklin. I mean, he was basically just the buggy driver. He didn't even go in the team room, you're right. That was surprising. I don't think anybody knew that.
No, mind-boggling. Of course, we like to jokingly refer to them as buggy drivers these days, but he generally was. So fantastic stuff. But I thought, Huggy, I like when we have guys of Bernard's ilk because I think they're a bit reflective and they want to talk about the past in a way that perhaps modern players don't yet because their careers are still going. So I thought it was a fabulous interview. I really enjoyed listening to it. And thanks for taking some time to introduce it for us today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Okay, welcome to the latest edition of the Thing About Golf podcast. My guest this time around is one of my favourite players when I was a wee boy. That makes him feel old, probably. But Bernard Gallagher, what was and is the thing about golf for you?
Well, golf for me started in Bathgate. And the main thing about Bathgate in the early days, apart from the BMC factory, was the golf course. Yeah. The golf course is right in the middle of town. So in the winter, I play football. In the summer, I play golf. And most of my friends did exactly the same. We had a very strong junior section. And that was about 10-year-old. And 12-year-old, I was still doing that. And by the time I got to 14, I was better at golf than football. So I gave up football and concentrated on golf. And so golf... And also, when I was at school, the golf course was right opposite the school, so I really didn't do a lot at school. Right. In fact, looking back in my life, I didn't really learn anything at school. And
Is that because you weren't interested? Or?
Well, yes, it's because I was so devoted to golf, and I never got pushed by my teachers, ever. And I was friendly with the chemistry teacher because he was a hip supporter like me, Tom O'Malley, who's passed away a couple of years ago, shame. Who became chairman of Hibs, actually.
I was going to say, that name rings a bell. Yeah.
So he was a chemistry teacher. And when I left school, I asked him, I said, Tom, why wasn't I pushed more at school? Not just by you, but by all the teachers. He said, all our teachers got together and said, we're going to leave you alone at school because you knew you wanted to be a golfer. And so I never really got pushed at all at school. You know, I got some O-levels, attempted to take my hires, but I mean, I gave up because I only interested in being a professional golfer.
From what age then? I mean, that's
16.
Yeah.
Yeah, 16. From 16. I turned professional at 17. And so, you know, and I didn't, in those days, yes, you wanted to play in tournaments and yes, you wanted to win golf tournaments. But, you know, if I wasn't successful when I turned professional and didn't win golf tournaments, I still wanted to be a golf pro. Yeah. So I wanted to be a club pro. So I wanted my life to be in golf.
Right.
And that's what I dedicated myself to. So that's what golf means to me.
Yeah. There was never any thought of, I mean, we're talking sort of late 60s, mid to
middle
late 60s.
60s. Yeah.
I mean, it's too soon for thinking about American colleges or anything like that.
Oh, God, no, I wasn't thinking about. The college system in those days wasn't as strong as it is today. Right. And the Americans, I never thought the Americans wanted anything to do with us over here. It's only in most recent history where the Americans are now encouraging foreign students to go across there, and it's really improved the college system.
Yeah.
But no, I didn't even want to go and play. I wasn't looking that far ahead. I just wanted to play. It was then a British tour with a few forages into Europe, play the French Open or Spanish Open, then come back again. And in the winter, you just practiced and waited for the tournaments to start again in April.
You were very young to turn pro, to be a tour pro.
17.
Yeah, I mean, you were a bit of a prodigy. I mean, you were pretty dominant at amateur level before you turned pro. I think that's
I never thought I was a very good player. I always thought there was better players than me around. But, you know, looking back, you know, I won.
That's a Scottish thing, isn't
it? Well, I think it is. But, you know, looking back, I was the county champion. I won the Lothians. I won the Scottish stroke play. I played in the Scottish boys team. I played in the British boys team. I played in the men's team. You know, I didn't think I would ever get in the Walker Cup team. I think, because there were personal picks in those days, and I always felt they were
changed.
No, I thought they were picking public schoolboys for the
Well, they did back in the day.
Well, yeah. apart from Ronnie Shade, they didn't, but he was just an outstanding player. And I admired Ronnie Shade so much and looked, and I sometimes played with him in the amateur scene in Edinburgh. But I didn't want to be like Ronnie, because Ronnie, he was in his 30s and still playing as an amateur golfer, and this is when I was like 16 and 17, and I admired Ronnie. I admired the way he's played and his dedication as an amateur. But, you know, I saw myself as being a professional.
Yeah, you know? Well, he was ridiculous. I mean, he won 5 Scottish amateurs in a row.
Did he? Yeah.
Match play.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, I mean, it's okay, it's down a couple of levels, but I mean, even 18-hole match play, as you well know, I mean, anything can happen. I mean, to win 5.
Well,
I know,
but he was outstanding. People were scared of him playing him in match play because he hit the ball so straight. Yeah. And I actually remember as leaving school and going 1966 to Muirfield when the Open was on there, And Ronnie was leading, I think, after two rounds, and I thought, he's going to win this because he's such a straight hitter.
Yeah.
And he ended up not winning it, and Jack Nicklaus won it. But he was right up there for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised to hear you say that you didn't think you were going to make the Walker Cup, because it didn't take you very long to make it into the Ryder Cup, let's be honest.
No, well,
1969,
no.
You were only 20, I think.
Yeah, I was 20. I never really looked that far ahead. I just really wanted to turn pro and see if I could make a living. I wanted to see if I could win a golf tournament first. Mm. And, you know, in 1969, when the Ryder Cup was on, I started that year not trying to make, you know, I didn't think I would think about the Ryder Cup. But I won a couple of tournaments and I finished runner-up five times. And that was my second year on the on the tour. And so I had a good year, but I didn't qualify for it. Funny, even with results like
that.
Oh,
really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, because it was taken over a two-year period.
All right.
And because we had played so badly, the Ryder Cup, say we, not me, but the team before 69 in 1967 lost by 15 points in Houston. To the Americans. I mean, it's quite laughable now because they talk today about the unprecedented loss that we did in Whistling Straits by 10 points. Well, I can only assume that is a European type 10-point loss.
Yeah.
But, you know, some of the reporters are saying that. Mm. Don't see it in European terms. It's like an unprecedented loss in the Ryder Cup.
Yeah.
But the British and the Irish team lost in the Ryder Cup by 15 points. That was a massacre in Houston, where Ben Hogan captained.
Yeah.
And so when they came back, we went, first of all, we decided to go to the big ball to improve the standard. That was the catalyst for becoming a big ball.
Do you remember where the first big ball tournament was on the European Tour?
Well, I take a guess and say it was Wentworth at Dax.
No, it was Dunbar, the Schweppes
PGA. Oh, the Schweppes at Dunbar. And I know who won it, David Talbot.
There you go, well done.
Yeah, because I remember walking around and watching them.
Yeah, right.
And, I think it was optional.
Was it? Right.
Yeah, mm. I think he won it with the big ball. But what to encourage you, if you won the tournament or you played it, you got extra money in your prize fund.
Really?
So that was how they sort of weaned you onto the big ball.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there were some protests about us going from small ball to big ball, especially from some people revered in the game like Peter Thompson. Mm. He thought it was a bad idea.
Yeah.
But eventually we went to the big ball, as you know, and the rest's history. But the Ryder Cup, we decided back then that they should have six automatics and six picks. And so I fell out the six automatics because it was done over a two-year period. And I was my first year in 1968, and I hadn't gathered enough points. And so Eric Brown was the captain from he came from Bathgate. And we always looked up to Eric in Bathgate. Yeah. He was our main inspiration. For the boys' section, we always wanted to be like Eric. Yeah. Eric had an indomitable force in the Ryder Cup. He won all his singles matches, and you know, he was a main inspiration for me, and not just me, all the boys on the team in the junior section. And so, Eric, it wasn't such a controversial thing to pick me because I was going to win the Order of Merit that year by the end of the year because I had such a good year. But I got picked, and I was the youngest at the time. I was 20 years old because they changed the rules to allow newcomers into the game. They didn't need to serve this 5 years apprenticeship as a PGA member before you could get in the team.
Well, they had daft rules like that in America.
Well, they had the same rule in America.
Jack Nicklaus's first Ryder Cup was yours.
It was, and he was a rookie in the 1969 Ryder Cup. The trouble with the only difference between Jack and me was that Jack had won four majors, and he was some rookie, you know.
Yeah.
And but I was a definite rookie, and I was 20 years old. And so it took a while for that record to be broken by Paul Way. And then by Sergio.
Right.
But they're all hanging around the same age as me, about 20 years old, but their months are different.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Because I came at the start of the year.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a bit annoying.
Yeah, so I was going to say, you sounded a bit bitter about that.
Yeah, not bitter, but annoyed.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that was the first Ryder Cup.
Yeah, it was a kind of a baptism of fire. I mean, and fairly controversial in the was one game in particular I'm thinking about that you were involved in. With Brian Huggett.
It was angry.
With Helen Still.
Yeah.
Yeah. Talk me through that.
Well, it was an angry, and it was an angry week. I had a run-in with Ken Still, actually. Maurice Bembridge and I played in the foursomes, the opening foursomes, against Ken Still and Lee Trevino. And early on, you know, my caddy was holding the flag for... What happened was Ken Still's caddy, it was a British caddy in those days, you didn't carry your caddies around with you. And Ken Still's caddy was holding the flag while I was about to putt from a distance on the third green. Mm-hmm. And just as I was about to putt, Ken Still shouts, "Get your own caddy to hold the flag." And, you know, in a way he was right, because if his caddy had held the flag and it came up and the ball hit it, we would have forfeited, we would have won the hole.
Yeah.
And so in a way, but it was the way it happened, you know, he was controversial and angry, and Trevino was as good as anything. So that was early in the week. Then Brian Huggett and I played Ken Still and Dave Hill on the Saturday afternoon's four ball match. And they putted out of turn. And also on the first green, Brian reprimanded them for walking around when he was putting. So we got off to a bad start.
Yeah.
You know, Brian wouldn't stand for any nonsense, no, to be honest. And then when they putted out of turn, he said, "You putted out of turn." And before Brian could say anything, he said, "Well, if this is the way you're going to play it, take the hole and take the goddamn cup."
Right.
And Brian said, "Well, if you're going to forfeit the hole, we're going to take it. Thanks very much."
Yeah.
So they forfeited the hole.
Yeah.
And it just got worse and worse from there. And eventually, there's no happy ending there, because Dave Hill, Ken Still didn't play very well, but Dave Hill beat Brian and I on his own and finished us off with an eagle at the 17th.
Yeah.
I mean, he played fantastic. It inspired him.
Yeah.
And he went one way and Ken Still went south.
Mm-hmm.
And we played okay, but he was on top form.
Yeah, but Dave Hill never minded pissing people off.
No, but Raymond Floyd said to me after the match, he said, we have the same problems with the same players no matter where we go.
Right.
This is what he said to me. And I was like 20 years old.
Aye.
I didn't know Raymond Floyd.
Yeah.
And he just said, you know, as if to dismiss it. He said, "We have the same problem. The same problems we have in America," meaning Dave Hill and Ked Still.
Yeah, yeah.
"We have the same problems with the same people."
Mm-hmm.
And because... you know, I didn't think we were doing anything wrong. Anyway, it was angry at the time. Everybody was angry, and the crowd were loving it, you know, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm sure, yeah. I mean, since we're talking about that, well, let's finish with the 69 Ryder Cup. I mean, it was a fantastic finish. I mean, the whole thing was a draw in the end.
It was,
but where were you anywhere close when Brian Huggett holed his putt on 18th?
I was on the 18th green.
Right.
And Brian had heard a shout on the 17th, and it's not like immediately you know today what's happening. There were no TV cameras around. And Brian had thought that Tony Jacklin had beaten Jack Nicklaus on the 17th, which meant Brian had to hold his 4-foot putt on the last green against Billy Casper to win us the Ryder Cup.
Right.
And Brian is the bravest putter you could ever meet.
Mm.
And he rammed this into the hole. Eric ran onto the green and... gathered him, and he was crying. We thought we'd won the Ryder Cup.
Yeah.
As it turned out, Tony had holed a huge putt to get level with Jack Nicklaus.
Yeah.
And so we were disappointed. I was around the green watching this, and I went across Brian and said, "Fantastic putt. It was great."
Mm-hmm.
No one wanted that 4-foot putt against Billy Casper. I mean, when you talk about Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer and Ben Hogan, I mean, my God, Billy Casper was a fantastic player, and I think he's even won more points than anybody else in Ryder Cups.
Well, I think he won 51 times in America.
I mean,
51!
Yeah.
You know.
The only thing he didn't do was win the Open Championship.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so he's not considered to be... up there with Jack.
Yeah. Well, I think the story is that he kind of was approached by McCormack.
Yeah.
And he said no. And so the big three went
became
on.
Became a big four.
And he got kind of sidelined by, you know, McCormack wasn't doing anything
for
him.
Well, his book, it was, his autobiography was The Big Three and Me.
Yeah. That's
I thought that was
which is fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's the way it was.
Yeah.
But a great player. And Brian holed that putt to level the match.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking... Tony had won the match, and we're going to win by a point.
Yes.
As it turned out, Tony Jacklin and Jack Nicklaus played the last hole for the Ryder Cup. And, you know.
What did you make of that? I mean, it's very famous, obviously, the concession that Nicholas did for Jacqueline. Would you have done that in that situation? It's a tough one, isn't it?
I'd like to think I would have, but yeah. I think at 20 years old, no, I wouldn't have.
Yeah.
Because I was quite competitive back then.
Yeah.
But, you know, Tony's since told me, you know, I said, what happened with that match? He said, well, we had both had our eyes off the 18th. And Jack shouted across to him, Tony. And so Tony went across. And Tony told me he was as nervous as hell walking up the fairway, last match for the Ryder Cup. And Jack said, Tony, how are you feeling? And Tony, as honest as anything, said, I'm as nervous as hell. He said, if it's any consolation, I'm feeling nervous as anything too.
Yeah.
And I think it helped him.
Classy, yeah.
Classy. Jack's classy.
Yeah.
And Tony played it great. Tony would have held that part. Tony was the best player in the world at that time.
Yeah, he was just.
I mean, he won the Open Championship at Birkdale. He was playing great. He was 6 months later, he was going to win the US Open by 7 shots. I mean, there was nobody better than Tony Jacklin at that time. And for this 2-foot putt or 18, whatever it was a tough putt. He was going to haul it, and Jack knew that, and that's why Jack picked it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and he would. But Tony's told me, so I'm glad I didn't need to have it. Not looking to do
well,
it.
Well, yeah.
Not looking for pressure.
It's only like bad things.
But he would, exactly. But he would have hauled it.
Yeah,
confident.
You mentioned him there. I mean, he'd gone to America. Now yeah. I asked you about America a minute ago. Were you ever tempted at that point to think, well, if he can do it, maybe I could too?
Well, you know, my mentality was different. I didn't really feel I was establishing myself in Britain at the time. And then Brian Barnes went across to America to the tour, because then you had to go to the tour school.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just wasn't prepared. Because if I go to the tour school, do I want to live in America? I mean, you've got to play, you've got to commit. And to be honest, I wasn't fully committed to living in America. Yeah. And as it turned out, Brian said, I'm going, are you coming with me? And Brian went, and Brian got his card. He finished third, I think, in a tour school, got his card. Yeah. But he didn't last.
But he had Brian, a perfect game for over there.
He had a perfect game, yeah. But I just didn't see any point unless I didn't have a driving ambition to play in America. Mm-hmm. And Brian did it, and I knew he would be back. Brian was playing tournaments in America, and he was doing well. But, you know, he was married, he had a kid at home, his family was in Storrington, and I couldn't, how's that going to last, you know, I mean, and even though at the time I wasn't married, I would be too homesick. Yeah. I didn't have a strong, burning desire to live in America, which you have to have.
Yeah, well, I've heard stories about you driving back to
Bathgate.
To the Hibs, to see the Hibs, yeah. And all sorts of things when you were young.
Yeah, I would do that, I would do daft things like that, and... I lived in Bathgate. I lived with my parents, and so even although I was representing Wentworth from 1970, I would go down there at times and spend some time with Tom Halliburton, the pro at Wentworth, and play with the members. Then I would go back home again. I sort of juggled it around, but I was more of a homebird. When I say a homebird, more a British, playing on the British tour, to be honest.
Let's continue with the Ryder Cup theme, if you will. I mean, you played, I don't know how many in a row.
Eight.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty remarkable record. I mean, you should be very proud of that. There's not many people did that, other than the absolute stars.
Yeah. I made it my ambition every Ryder Cup year to get in the team. Mm-hmm. And I play more tournaments. And so when the Ryder Cup, if you look through my record, you'll see I didn't really do what did okay, but during a non-Ryder Cup year.
Oh, hang on a minute. Oh, you're talking about record outside the Ryder Cup. Well, I'm going to run through your singles record in a minute.
I'm a singles record. Yeah. But I didn't really, you know, from 75 on, I was also the pro at Wentworth.
Mm-hmm.
And so When it was 1976 was an even year, so there wasn't a Ryder Cup that year. I wouldn't play as many tournaments. 77 was a Ryder Cup, but suddenly play because I want to be in the team. And that's the way, that was my mentality.
Yeah.
And that's why I was playing all these tournaments in a row, because I made it my ambition to be in the Ryder Cup. It was something to look forward to, something to aim for. And so I'd play a lot of tournaments. I'd play them at the start and make sure I'd gather points and things like that. Because off the eight, I made the team automatically in every one except the first one. right. when I finished first in the order of merit. I mean, that's the irony.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, of course, because it was done over 2 years. But so there we go.
Anyway, as I say, I was going to mention, people won't realise this. I hadn't looked at it. I knew it was good. But I looked at your singles record here. In the Ryder Cup, you have beaten Nicholas Trevino, Coody and Watkins, and halved with Trevino again, Guy Berger, Bill Rogers, who was at the top of his game at the time, and Dave Stockton. Mm. I mean, every single one of them is a major champion.
Yeah, I seem to play well against them.
Yeah.
I do remember playing Al Guy Berger. It was Laurel Valley in 75, and he got down out and up and down out a bunker at the 18th from about 50 yards. I couldn't believe he hit it stone dead. Right. And Lee Trevino that same year, I had two half matches then against Trevino. I had a good record against Trevino. I mean, I played him in the first Ryder Cup and I beat him 3-2 or 4-3. Mm. I was on top of my game and I was inspired by what Eric Brown told me. And I went out there and shot 32 in the front nine, had 3 or 4 up, and, you know, he wasn't going to beat me. And so I remember that match particularly well. But
I'm remembering a ridiculous putt that you hold against Nicholas at the 17th green.
But Nicholas was a particularly difficult match, as you can imagine, 1977. The only thing was, it was a match that we were always losing. But I was playing Jack Nicklaus in 1977 in the singles in match 6. And, you know, it was a bit of a moment. I had my putter stolen the evening before.
Really?
Yeah, and I kept it quiet. And I looked upon that as a positive because I was putting poorly. And somebody had stolen the putter. The caddy had left it down by the putting green, gone into the bathroom, the locker room, and come back. And I didn't really know until the morning of the match. And I said, "Where's the putter?" "Oh, can't tell you." Mm. So I went into the pro shop at Lytham and bought a ping putter. It was just the start of the ping, which is a completely different putter, a ping putter, when it first came out.
Yeah.
And the ping putter, when they first came out, it pinged. Mm. And it accelerated. And, you know... So when you putt, you could never leave it short because it came off so fast.
Right.
And I thought, that's just what I need because I've been leaving everything short.
Right.
So I just got this putter and it took my mind off the Jack Nicklaus match, to be honest. And then we get on the first hole, you know, par 3 at Royal Lytham is a tough opening hole, 200 and something yards, par 3. And I'm on the green and Jack's short. Jack chips up to about 4 feet and I putt down to about... Well, I'm thinking I'm... putting down to just under 2 feet. And as Jack's looking at his putt, he gives me the putt. And I just couldn't believe it. I said, because it was a difficult putt on the first green. And I'm going, thanks. Okay, I'm taking it quickly, not trying to look too relieved.
Yeah.
Anyway, Jack misses his putt. And so I'm one up. I said, fine. And then at the second, the third... I go 3 up, and I birdied the fourth to go 4 up. I'm sort of 4 up against Jack. And at the fifth hole was a par 3. I hit my tee shot to 6 feet, and I missed it. Otherwise, I'd been 5 up. And then the par 5 round the corner, I was on for 2 and 3 putted. So I could easily have been 6 up. Yeah. I couldn't quite... I was shell-shocked. I was shell-shocked, to be honest, as what's going on. But, of course... some part of me saying this isn't going to end well.
Yeah.
even 4 up after 6 holes, this isn't going to end well.
Yeah.
Just make the best of it.
Yeah.
And I'm now trying to hang on, make pars, but Jack makes a birdie at the next par 5, and then he makes another birdie at the next one. And then at the 16th, I'm 1 up still, so I'm hanging on, and then Jack hold a good putt at 16. We're all square. Okay, all square. I've done quite well. But at 17th, I hit my second just short of the green. I'm just short of the green, and I hold this putt. It must have been 70 feet.
Oh, ridiculous.
Yeah, ridiculous putt.
I remember you burst out laughing.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it because I was trying to putt it up there. Yeah. I've more or less given up the match. I think Jack will finish birdie and polish me off. But I beat him. I beat him on 18. I hold a good 4-foot putt on the last. He didn't give me this putt on the last green. It was about 4 feet. And I just knocked, rammed it right in there, and I beat Jack on the last green. And to be honest, I've been quite friendly with Jack in some sort of way ever since, in as much as he sends us Christmas cards.
Right.
And, you know, it was a great experience to play Jack. Very nervous to start with. Jack makes you feel very comfortable. You're walking up the fairway, he chats to you and things like that. Makes you relaxed. Nice guy.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he was
the best.
He always had the right attitude to the Ryder Cup, but certainly back then.
Do you know, he's got the right attitude to everything, and that's why he won the majors, mm-hmm. because he just thinks differently.
Yeah.
And he can think with such clarity under pressure.
Yeah.
And he can produce the big shot under pressure. He can hit the big drive under pressure and down the middle. He can hold the putt under pressure.
Yeah.
He's just different. I mean, I know Tiger's done similarly type things, but Jack was up against all these other great players. And you can start in the Hogan era, mm-hmm. Sam Snead era, Arnold Palmer, Gary Player, Billy Casper, Raymond Floyd. I mean, Jack was still winning the Masters at 46 years old. You know, he's beaten all these guys and Greg Norman and Seve and Tom Watson and all the rest of it. And he's older. He's 10 years older than these guys.
Yeah.
And he's got a career outside golf as being the best golf course designer. I mean, he was amazing, absolutely amazing.
He was the kind of driving force behind the change to European rather
than
British.
That was 1977.
Yeah, I mean, you're one of the few that are still knocking around that mm-hmm. played, you can say you played for Britain in the Europe in the Ryder Cup and for Europe.
Yeah.
Were you kind of behind that? Did you approve of that change at the time? Can you remember?
Well, there's a lot of people against it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people thought it should just remain.
Yeah.
And, you know, if the Americans didn't want to turn up and play against Britain and Ireland, forget it. Let's just put the cup away in the drawer somewhere. But eventually, it was a sensible thing to do, mainly because of Seve. Because Seve was coming along, and there was Europeans coming along that were good, and we were becoming a European side. And so the PGA and the European Tour got together with the PGA of America and said, we changed the trust deed to incorporate Europe.
Yeah.
So we changed the name, became a European side.
Right.
And but that was to do with two things. Jack Nicklaus said, we have to be more competitive. And the other thing was Seve would come along. Seve had come along in 1976. He just finished runner-up in the Open to Johnny Miller at Tiburton. He could see he was going to be one of the great players.
Yeah.
And so you would want Seve in that team.
And yet, he didn't do that well in 79. I mean, maybe
Then
in 81, he wasn't even picked.
In 79, he and Antonio Garrido were the first two to play, and they didn't do well at all.
No, I mean, Larry Nelson he beat them up
time. Larry Nelson beat everybody up. I mean, Larry Nelson and Lanny Watkins are unbeatable.
Yeah.
And at foursomes and four ball. And I think Seve realised that, I mean, when Seve came on, we're thinking 5 points. You know, we think Seve, great player, 5 points. But I think Seve got an awakening. I think he realised this is special.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, he didn't play in 81 because of his dispute with the European Tour.
Neil Coles did this podcast with me a while ago.
Oh, did he?
And he was one of the three people that was voting on that.
Mm-hmm.
And he revealed back then that it was him and Bernard Langer that voted Seve out. John Jacobs was the third guy, and he was the captain. He wanted Seve. Well, why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
But the other two said no. So that was Seve out.
Yeah. That's true, I remember John coming to me on the practice ground at Fulford and saying, should I pick Seve? I said, yes. I said, I don't care what he's done.
Yeah.
I said, and I'm thinking if I was the captain, I would definitely pick him. But John did not want to go against the committee, the European Tour committee. So there was Bernard Langer on the committee. And the Spaniards on the committee, I think the Spaniards around felt that Seve didn't deserve to be on it because he was in dispute with the tour.
It was appearance money, wasn't it?
It was to do with appearance money, And the tour was put in a bad position in those days. We were trying to ban appearance money. Sometimes the appearance money was bigger than the total fund. And Americans would be able to come across, get appearance money. And Seve was banned from accepting it because European Tour members were not allowed to take it.
Mm-hmm.
So you end up at the Swedish Open, two or three Americans playing, getting £50,000 in Seve playing, getting nothing, and he's a star man.
Yeah.
Well, it's understandable he's annoyed.
I got his point, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but they just, it was just, I got
appearance
his, we all got his point.
It's a thorny issue, isn't it, appearance money? Yeah. I mean, I think it's unrealistic to think that you're ever going to get rid of it, because it just takes one tournament or one manager or one whatever to break the rule, and that's it. It's everybody's free for all after that, isn't it?
It's subtle the way they do appearance money now.
Yeah.
You know, it's through other means.
You go to a cocktail party.
Well, it's you've got a contract with the sponsor doing other things, not appearing to play, but doing other things for the sponsor. Yeah. You know, I don't want to make this into a controversial, acrimonious podcast here, but it's going on today.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Whenever you see Tiger playing, Rory playing, you know, they're incentivized.
They don't go anywhere for nothing.
No, they're being incentivized in some sort of way to play. And Rory's absolutely great. He tries to support European Tour as much. But, you know, it's understandable he's a star man, and there's benefits, there's side benefits.
Mm-hmm. Tiff Tough Hybrid Bermuda means less work and more play. Tough by name and by nature, this turf variety, supplied exclusively by Lawn Solutions Australia, is the perfect choice for your home lawn. With superior drought tolerance, speedy recovery and toughness, Tiff Tough really is the smart grass. For more information and to find your nearest accredited supplier, head to lawnsolutionsaustralia.com.au.
Anyway, I didn't want to wander off the Ryder Cup subject too much. I mean, we're getting to the point where your last time as a player was 83, which was the first time that really looked like it, man, this is competitive now. This is this, you must have a wee bit of a regret that you never played on a winning team.
Yeah.
And you were 2 years too early. You
know? Well, I played eight in a row, and the first one was a drawn match. Mm-hmm. And although I played pretty well, you know, winning some, well, losing some.
That list
I got quite a few points. Yeah. But Brian Barnes and I had a good record in foursomes and four ball too, so I was collecting points there. Mm-hmm. But it was ironic that 1983, I was devoting more time to the pros job at Wentworth than I was to playing, and I couldn't make the team. And Tony Jacklin was the captain 85 for the Belfry match. He said, if I had half a chance, I'd pick you. I said, don't worry, Tony. I'll just do whatever you want. I said, I don't deserve to be in the team. Mm-hmm. And I didn't deserve to be in the team. And so 83 became my last match. But I was struggling 83 to make the team. I made the team by the skin of my teeth, but I felt that was the end, you know.
It's funny how you know
it's quite, I was still quite young, but, you know, I wasn't playing enough tournaments. I was enjoying home life, the kids growing up. I had a great job at Wentworth that I was enjoying. I enjoyed playing, teaching with the members. You know, it was difficult to drag yourself away and play three or four tournaments in a row to try and make a team. Yeah. And I wasn't, and I did it in 83, but I could see I wasn't going to do it after that. But saying that, I was, of course, delighted that we won, because...
Well, you were involved still.
I was involved in a way, but, you know, Tony called me...
Yeah, tell me what the vice-captain does.
Well, exactly. Tell me, what do I do? Because I wasn't privy to what went on in the team room, like it is today. For me, the...
You weren't in the team room?
No, absolutely not.
Wow.
And, I never saw that as my position. Tony called me a vice-captain when he came to the end of his captaincy. But I never really felt I was anything more than a helper driving his buggy. And in 85, I was no more than a supporter, driving his buggy around the golf course, getting him to the right spots.
You had no input into
it. And then I walked away when the match had gone, and I went to the restaurant, and I wasn't in the team room for anything.
Wow,
Tony kept it all. And that was the correct way. Because before Tony, I mean, John Jacobs didn't have a vice-captain. Bernard Hunt didn't have a vice-captain. Eric Brown didn't have a vice. Brian Huggett didn't have a vice-captain. They didn't, you know, at the end of the day, it's a captain's decision.
No, they've got five.
Yeah, I know, I find it amusing. But
don't touch that.
No, I find it amusing now that they've got all these vice-captains, because at the end of the day, the buck ends with the captain.
Aye.
And, so you can get this feedback and feedback and feedback as much. Sometimes it can be too confusing, the feedback. But, you know, Tony Jacklin wanted to do it on his own, and I respected that, and he did a great job. Mm-hmm. And he was very close to the players and got Seve and Nick Faldo and Sam, Bernard Langer, and they were all in there, and they all wanted to play for themselves and play for Tony. And it was a great camaraderie and chemistry that he built up. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't prepared to, in any way, to get in the middle of that.
And your role not evolve? You were vice captain a few times.
Yeah, no. My role remained the same from 85. Then there was 87 in America. Well, what happened was in 87 at Muirfield Village, the golf bags didn't turn up. And they were all wrong when they did turn up. This is a player's bag. They came in a special plane.
Really?
And they weren't there. And I said, Tony, this is just up my street. I'll deal with that. Mm-hmm. And I just dealt with that. I dealt with Titleist who were building the bags and getting them printed up. And all.
Were the names wrong or what was it?
There was something wrong with the bags.
Right.
There was something wrong. I can't exactly whether they didn't even turn up, but they were wrong. And of course, my experience being the pro at Wentworth and dealing in retail,
I knew
exactly what to do. I knew exactly the bag they wanted, the colours, and I told them what to do. Now, I did that job, and the bags arrived in time for the final.
So we should now refer to you forevermore as the bag man.
The bag man, yeah, exactly. So anyway, that was a good job I did there. Then after I got the bags all right, I was driving Tony's buggy around. Actually, driving a buggy around, of course, isn't as easy as you think, because you've got to know where you're going.
Yeah.
Not only in the golf course, but to that point in the match that's important, where the captain wants to be seen and how to get there. For so-and-so's just gone one up at the 14th. Right, let's go and try and gee him along, get him over the line.
So we've got bagman and taxi driver.
Buggy driver.
Right, buggy driver.
No, buggy driver. But after that, no. Tony was in the team room with the players and they were having their dinner and evenings all together in this team room. I didn't want to be there anyway.
Well, I can understand that maybe, but I think people will be astonished, as I am, to hear that, that you weren't involved at all, really.
No, I wasn't involved in that at all. In 89, it came to the end, and I was down the fairway. I was down there. First of all, in 85, I was on the tee. I was just on the tee with Tony when Sam hit that great drive down the last. And then from there, he hit it on the green, hit a putt in the hole. You know, it was a great putt.
Oh, wow. It's amazing.
It was an amazing way to finish. Yeah. Of course, indelibly on everybody's mind, especially mine being there.
Yeah.
And then 89, I was right down the fairway. So I've had some big moments when I was there helping, not being involved when Christy O'Connor hit that. I didn't know it was a 2-iron until he hit it, but it was a fantastic laser-type shot from the middle of the fairway.
Everybody in Ireland got that 2-iron. He gave it away a few times in China.
It's been bought a few times. JP McManus must have about 100 2-irons.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Having bid for it about 100 times.
Let's hope we're not giving anything away there, but I don't think we are.
No.
And so anyway, you went straight into being the captain. I mean, you would have been an obvious captain anyway at some point, but I mean, how did that come about?
Well, I just voted in a committee and I got voted in. Probably thought you've played a lot, you've got the experience of being with Tony, so I became the captain in 91, which was great. And so the war on the shore in Kiwa Island.
Well, I was going to say that. The magazine I worked for, we were the ones that came up with that.
Was it?
It was a guy called Jim Herry. He was the managing editor of the magazine.
Well, he's right.
The war on, it turned out to be right.
Yeah, he's right.
This was before it even happened.
Yeah, the spectators got involved.
Yeah.
And spectators got involved. And they actually, in some way, threatened the Ryder Cup. Because when the spectators gets involved, it's trouble. Mm-hmm. I mean, even Rory the other day said the spectators are starting to get involved in America. Max Honma's getting booed. Mm-hmm. And they're relating that to gambling.
Right, yes.
On the golf course. And Rory McIlroy is quite right. It's bad when spectators get involved. Okay, you can cheer and think, but don't try and put players off.
Mm.
Well, I thought the American spectators in 91 were trying to put us off by their noisy, unruly behaviour.
Yeah.
And I'm told other things, you know, like good lies in the rough and things like that. So that's what I've been told from some of the European supporters that are walking around telling me, but they're telling me after the match. Mm-hmm. We don't want to go into that in too great a detail, but
I'm still intrigued by how Hale Irwin's drive off the 18th hole got to where it finished.
Well, yeah, it was, well, it was nothing to do with Hale Irwin.
No, not at all.
He pull hooked it off the 18th,
yeah.
And I was on the 18th. Mm. And Bernard Langer hit an imperious drive. Mm. And when I got up there, I was surprised to see it just off the fairway, because that's not where he hit it.
No.
No, but saying that, there was a lot of crowds, and you can hit a crowd and you can come back in, you know. So, but his where he hit it, I thought, no chance.
Yeah.
Thick rough, dunes are over there. And when I came up, he got it. He was able to hit it up.
Yeah.
He couldn't reach the green, but he was getting it up there.
Yeah, as you say, that was the first sign of it. I mean, I've been to a few Ryder Cups in America, and I was there at Brookline and walked around with Monty when he was playing Payne Stewart. Yeah. And it's appalling at times. I mean, some of the language that was thrown at Monty that day was...
And his father.
Yeah, his father had to walk off.
Yeah, that was a shame. His father was upset.
I mean, it's and I've had another player who shall remain nameless, but it told me after Medina, when the Europeans won, Poulter, etc., he said that he was heckled on every single full shot he hit. Every single one.
Yeah, really.
And, I mean, they're going to Bethpage next time around in 25. I mean, that's going to be a zoo. Well, I'm kind of worried about that, you know.
Well, I, after Kiwa Island, I thought they were threatening the future of the Ryder Cup, to be honest. And if that happens, if as bad as what we fear might happen at Bethpage in New York, then, you know, they're jeopardising the Ryder Cup, because we wanted to be competitive.
Well, I can see players going, oh, I'm had enough at this, I'm off.
Well, that's right, I don't need all this hassle. No, exactly. Especially they're all wealthy nowadays. Anyways, I don't need to, I'm getting paid to do this.
So you mentioned you get a Christmas card from Jack Nicklaus. I'm assuming you don't get one from Dave Stockton every year.
Well, I got one at first.
Did you?
Yeah. Actually, I saw him at Whistling Straits, and it was nice as night.
Right, good.
But the Christmas card he sent me after the Ryder Cup in 91... was a Christmas card with the American team on the pub celebrating their victory with the thing.
Yeah.
You know.
And was that the one where they showed the film beforehand? It was all American shots. Was that 91?
That was 91 at Gala Dinner.
Yes.
Yeah, but the Christmas card was not a festive card.
No, no.
It was just a up yours card.
Yeah. So I take it you didn't reciprocate,
no? No, I wasn't going to send him one anyway. Yeah. But saying that, you know, I've met him a few times and get on all right. Yeah. You know, it's just that Dave Stockton is a very competitive guy, apparently.
Yes.
And Peter Oosterhuis warned me at the time he's very competitive.
Yeah. He had the same kind of game as you, to be honest. I mean, he was magnificent from 100 yards in, like you were.
He was a better putter than me.
The long game wasn't as good.
Yeah, his putting is exceptionally good.
Yeah.
And
but you're come on now.
Sorry, no, my shot
you
game.
Often enough.
Yeah, no, I've had my moments. And, but I mean, my best game was the iron shots and short irons, and from 100 yards, I'm good. Yeah. But I wouldn't say I'm a great holer out. I had my moments like a lot of players, but not consistently week in and week out. I've always felt, and long putting's always been my weakness. But my iron shots have all been good. My three wood, if I've got trouble off the tee, I'm sure to hit the fairway with a three wood.
Mm-hmm.
So I had parts of my game were good.
Yeah.
And of course, my driving was irregular because I was trying to hit it so hard all the time to try and keep up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when I calmed down, tried to get a shot where you only needed to hit the fairway, I could always nail a three wood out there. Mm-hmm. I was very happy to do that.
Yeah.
My long irons are always good too.
You obviously were not put off by the off the captaincy in 91 because you went on to do it two more times, which I don't think anybody's ever going to do again. Probably,
no.
But
in those days, you got two matches.
Yeah,
Most captains got two matches. Mm-hmm. The surprise is that I got three matches.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you did, for obvious reasons.
Well, as it turned out, but I was surprised I was offered a third one because, you know, I felt it was time to give up.
Aye.
But Ken Schofield said to me, you know, a few of the players think it's going to be tough in America. We need some experienced players. Because when I took over from Tony, my first match was away from home.
Mm-hmm.
And so anybody who takes over from me, the first match is going to be away as well.
Yeah.
So you're, you know, in those days, it's a hiding to nothing, your first match being in America.
Yeah.
And he said, and then one of the players wrote me a nice letter and said, you know, it's going to be tough in America. We can win it over there, of course, but it's good to have somebody experienced to do it. So, you know, as it turned out, it was a good move. I accepted it.
And yet the, there's much made of the it's 30 years since Europe lost a Ryder Cup in Europe, but you're, I hate to bring this up, but you're the last captain to lose.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah. What are your memories of 93?
Well, my memories of 93 were that we were going along well and we were winning the Ryder Cup after the Saturday foursomes. We could have won the Ryder Cup in the afternoon if we had a good Saturday afternoon. I didn't have Sam after Sam. Sam poisoned his toe in the first match, playing with Mark James in the opening foursomes. So he couldn't play the rest of the week. Mm-hmm. The doctor said to me, if he plays in singles, we'll have to give him an injection on the first tee and another one in the ninth tee.
Yeah.
And I brought Tom Watson into the thing. I said, well, Tom, do you think it's fair that this player needs an injection on the first tee and then another injection on the ninth tee to get round? He said, no. I said, well, neither do I. Because it made a difference because he's got to take out one of his players, the pair up, and we got a half point. Getting back to the Saturday afternoon match, we can build a big lead. But Seve didn't want to play in the Saturday afternoon, which came as a shock to everybody because he had won both his matches playing with Ole Thabo. He was in trouble with his game. He knew that. But Ole Thabo and I remonstrated with him down the middle of the 14th fairway when he called me, and he was two up at the time against Davis Love and Tom Kite in the foursomes. And I said, "But Seve," I said, you must surely want to play." He said he didn't want. It was the most extraordinary conversation, because never have I known Seve not want to play, and he just did not want to play. And that's where I say that was the start of Seve's downfall on the 14th fairway at the Belfry in the foursomes match in the Ryder Cup. Seve knew that you had to put your pairings in by 12 o'clock, and so he called me out in the course because his was the last match, and it was getting to be 12 o'clock, and he called me out because he rightly thought I'd be putting them both out in the afternoon. And I said, you are going to play. He said, no, I'm not, I can't play. So Ole Thabo, 5 minutes, it was well documented on television, us on television trying to get him to play.
Yeah.
And Ole Thabo and I had to walk away in the end, and so he didn't play. He went to the practice ground trying to find some sort of game, lost in the singles, and I would say the whole morale went down in the team.
Yeah, because he was such an inspirational.
Yeah, he was inspirational, but the team's morale went down. But saying that, the cards fell against us, and Barry Lane was winning against Chip Beck in the singles, and Chip Beck went eagle birdie eagle par, and Barry's like two up with five to play, and he suddenly finishes eagle birdie eagle, and then half the last, and they went in the last green. So, and it's a shame because I was just thinking about that recently, because Barry Lane passed away not so long ago, and it was so sad in that particular match, because that was a difficult point to lose. And then for the match to fall on the shoulders of Constantina Rocca against Davis Love, the experienced Davis Love, I think it was quite difficult. That was the first Italian ever to play in the Ryder Cup. There was a lot of pressure on him. Suddenly the Ryder Cup's on him. I thought that was... I wasn't trying to plan it that way, I can tell you. That's why I was so pleased that Rocca 97 beat Tiger Woods, which turned the match at Valderrama in the singles.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And I was so pleased for Constantino Rocca that he won it for Seve, because all the pressure fell on him at the Belfry in 93. And then a few years later, and he played well at 95, I must say. He and Sam Torrance were a great combination.
You saw a bit of the best of Seve and Ollie, though, didn't you? I mean, how remarkable were they? I mean, 91 at Kiowa, they were unbelievably good, weren't they?
Well, I saw Seve as Tony's helper, or vice captain, whatever you want to hear. But, I mean,
you saw the start of it.
Yeah, well, I saw the start of Seve since he started, because Manuel Pinheiro, his brother, was playing on the tour. And then he told us, you know, Seve, my young brother's coming on, get used to him being around. And so Manuel was a nice guy, and he sort of nursed Seve onto the... And, of course, he took the whole tournament scene, you know, it was like a burst of energy. Yeah. I mean, the way he played. Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing that amuses me, you know, is everyone thinks, looking back on Seve's career, oh, great player, hit it all over the place, chip and putted like a demon. He was a great long straight hitter. Mm-hmm. I mean, in 85, he stood up on the 10th tee with a persimmon-headed driver and a softer ball and hit a fade into the middle of the 10th green. Mm. And Curtis Strange could only hit a 7-iron shot and Manuel two-putted for the victory.
Yeah.
I mean, he took it on because he knew he could do it. Mm. And he won 5 world match players at Wentworth.
Yeah. Well, I always say to people that, you know, you can argue whether he was a great driver or not, but he was the hitter of great drives.
Exactly. He was the hitter of great drives. Yeah. But for most of his time, he hit long, straight drives. Mm-hmm. He was driving it past Greg Norman.
Yeah.
And Greg Norman was considered, the thing about Greg Norman was so straight and long. But when Seve at his best, he was driving it further than Greg Norman. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And no, his demise happened in 1993. Yeah. It was about that time. And John Jacobs forecast it was going to happen because of the way he swung the club. He was always going to have back issues, John said. And sure enough, it was back issues that caused him to hit it all over the place.
Yeah.
Because he was actually swinging it much slower and going more offline.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a contradiction.
Yeah. I mean, how much did you watch of him in 95 at Oak Hill against Lehman?
Well, I watched more or less the whole match. Yeah. Not.
Have you ever seen anything like that in your life?
No.
Because I walked as well. I mean, it was unbelievable.
Well, I had written Seve off. You know that.
Really? Yeah.
And so the longer he played, the better it was for me and the team.
Yeah.
Because it instilled the fighting spirit in the team that he was so determined to keep going. Mm-hmm. And so it helped us in many respects. But yeah, he was never going to beat Tom Lehman, who was a great player. And Seve, of course, was really finished after that match. Mm-hmm. And the reason he got in that match, he qualified for the team, you know. For a year beforehand, when the process started where you could gather points, he was getting lessons off a guy called Mac O'Grady. Mm-hmm. And they were very successful. Mm-hmm. And he won the BMW, which was a big prize fund in those days. It more or less propelled him up the money list and got him straight in the team. But then, sadly, they fell out, Mark O'Grady and Seve, and, you know.
They fell out with everybody, let's be
honest. Yeah, yeah. and it didn't continue, put it that way.
Yeah.
And Seve's game went downhill. So it went downhill for a number of reasons, mainly because of his health. Mm. Shame. Yeah. But great player, inspirational player, terrific. Terrific holer out. And as we all know, any shot, he could play any shot.
Yeah. That was a great way for you to finish your official relationship with the Ryder Cup, I'm imagining. I can still see you jumping up in the air.
Well, I was happy, I was happy. There was a number of things happy, you know. The match was starting to fold out. I liked the way the singles draw came out. Mm-hmm. I mean, all the players, apart from Seve, I thought all the players, this guy playing that, with Matt James going off second and Howard Clark going off third. I like Sam playing Leon Roberts. I like Monty playing Ben Crenshaw. I liked Bernard Langer, but it didn't turn out, playing David's Love. I liked that, but David's Love beat him. But then, further down, I liked, you know, they don't know Philip Walton. He's a good player. He's playing Jay Haas. That's okay. But I really like Nick Faldo playing Curtis Strange.
Mm-hmm.
And
why do you say that?
Well, because they're two good players, obviously, and it was always going to be a crucial time in the match. You know, it's not at the end, it's two or three matches from the end, and Curtis Strange is a straight hitter, Nick's a straight hitter. You know, it just looked good. And of course, when it came to the bit and Nick's got this 4-foot putt to beat Curtis Strange, I just sat down and my wife was sitting with me and Mark James and Jane James were sitting beside me. And I said, if there's one guy I wanted to be there to hold a 4-foot putt for me and for the Ryder Cup, and if it was for your life, you'd want Nick Faldo to hold it. And, you know, it was... nervously put in. I know Nick said he felt nervous over
it. Well, it was the sort of part, and I think he said this himself, that it was a very difficult one to lay stiff. You either had to hold it or it was 6 feet past.
Yeah.
You know, one of those.
He just, when Fanny lined it up for him, he had this strength of character and the presence to hit it properly. And then of course, but you know, just before that, we have David Guildford playing this match against Barry Faxon. I mean, and David Guildford's the straightest hitter in the world, and he's down the middle at the last.
But he can no chip.
Well, no one could chip there, but his 5-wood came straight at the flag because a difficult high shot.
Yeah.
And it was like 5 yards too far. I thought he was actually going to almost hole it. And of course, the big collars around the green. He's now on a downslope. Green run away from you. There's nobody could get this shot, even David, who's maybe a difficult part of his game. And Brad Faxon in the front bunker, and he sort of chips it up and leaves it 4 feet short, straight up the hill. So you're giving him that four. So how is it going to work this? Because David's one up, and I'm looking closely at the board. And although Nick's shot putt and his result against Curtis Raines meant we couldn't lose the Ryder Cup, he got in that position because of David Guildford, the previous match. And so David hits his first chip and he doesn't make the green. We knew that. It was either just going to dribble on the green and be okay. Then the next one, he hits it on the green. He must have hit it 15 feet. And it's right across the side and he hold it. So, but we're thinking, and the best putter on the US tour misses it from 4 feet straight up the hill. That's what the Ryder Cup can do to somebody.
It's fine margins, isn't it?
Yeah, fine margins, but it's frightening. But that's what the Ryder Cup, the pressure. Suddenly it's not the pressure just about you missing and your caddy. Suddenly you've got the whole weight on your shoulders off America. All America on your shoulders. And that's difficult to handle.
Yeah.
He couldn't handle it.
No.
And despite having a fantastic method and being a nice guy, that doesn't count for anything.
No.
Because he's the nicest guy in the world. But then Philip Walton's the unsung hero. He managed to hang on and beat Jay Haas.
I mean, my mind, when people ask about pressure in the Ryder Cup, my mind always goes to that game. Yeah. But it goes to Jay Haas.
Yeah.
I mean, he popped it up off the last day. I mean, the poor guy could barely walk. Never mind hit shots. No. I mean, I've never, and he'd won tournaments and been, well, you know.
Great. He's the most consistent. Yeah. I think he's won more money in his pension fund than anybody else.
Yeah.
And the funny thing was that a few years later, he won the British, the American seniors on that course
at
Oak Hill.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. I looked out for that one. And so.
But that's where my memory goes, is the sight of him on that hole. I mean, it was. Gibbering wreck. I mean, he couldn't do anything.
No.
It was amazing.
No, it was. Yeah, it was just. He'd never hit it offline before.
No.
He was a straight hitter.
Yeah.
It's, suddenly he hit it in the trees.
Yeah, it's fine margins with this, as you say about the Ryder Cup. I mean, even I can go back to, and I've said this before on here, but the last match of Whistling Straits, you know, on the Saturday night, they're 6 points behind. But that's Rory. Rory had played poorly for him and lost three games. Rory plays well, wins three, they're tied.
Yeah.
I mean, the top players have got a huge responsibility, I think, in the Ryder Cup. And if they play well, two or three of your best players play well, you're going to win.
Well, I've got a theory about that, and you're right about Whistling Straits, because I was there as the PJ captain, and I was only told I could go a week before, because COVID restrictions, they weren't letting anybody in.
Yeah.
And so this was a different experience. It was almost a surreal experience for our team because there were no supporters there and didn't get any support at all.
Yeah.
And there are 40,000 Americans with no masks there, and you must wonder why we weren't allowed to get a couple of thousand in.
Yeah.
But there were 40,000, no masks, all cheering for their sides. When Rory's hitting his booming drive off the first, it was blank. There was nobody there.
Yeah.
And then when Bryson DeChambeau hit his tee shot on the green at the first, the whole world came in. There was so noise. So suddenly Rory and suddenly all the guys, John Rahm and all our team are playing. They're playing in a lack of atmosphere. And it took Rory, I think, a little while to get used to this.
Yeah.
And I calculated out that 18 matches went down the 17th and we only won 5 points. And that's a time where you need your supporters just to a little bit. Now, I don't think for 1 minute we're ever going to win that match, but I think the loss would have been much less if we'd had a half decent support. Yeah, yeah. Contrasting that to 2012 at Medina, when we did come back from, four points, we had a big support there. I mean, a huge support in Chicago, and it inspired the players, especially when Ian Poulter birdies five of the last five holes on Saturday afternoon to beat Zach Johnson and Jason Duffner, and Rory's partner's a spectator.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a strong case for one guy winning at the Ryder Cup, and that was Ian Poulter right there.
Yeah.
And but the crowd responded, and they went out the next day and they saw this banner in the sky. It said, "Do it for Seve." And Olatabo had Seve's on his bag, he had Seve on the sweaters. It's a bit creepy, actually.
A wee bit.
Yeah, I found it a bit creepy. But the players bought into it.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, and when in that Sunday morning you arrive at the golf course and a little plane had gone up and had printed in the sky, "Do it for Seve," you know, I was a bit choked, to be honest.
Yeah,
I
felt a bit choked. Yeah, because it wasn't that long.
Because Seve's not there.
Yeah.
And we're doing it for Seve, and the players just went out and played great.
Yeah, it was a remarkable day.
Inspired by Ian Poulter and a Seve who wasn't there.
I mean, Oak Hill was a bit like that. I mean, almost everything that had to happen did.
Yeah,
happen.
It did happen. Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, we got off to a great start apart from Seve, and Mark was winning, Howard Clark was winning, Sam was winning, Monty was winning.
What's your philosophy on both the order of play and who plays with who? What kind of player plays with them, personalities and all that juggling you have to do with partnerships? Because you and Brian Barnes were two very different people.
Not a lot of people could play with Brian.
Yeah.
Because I was friendly with him because he gave the impression that he chucked it quickly, but he never did. No. I knew what he was like.
Yeah.
But when I was captain, I said that everybody would play before singles. Everyone would play a match.
Yeah.
You've all played here. You all deserve to play a match before the singles. And I said, if anyone's not happy with who they want to play with, I said, come and let me know.
Mm.
I said, but if no one comes, I said, I want to have the freedom to put you with whoever you want.
Mm-hmm.
So I left it up to the players.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, you know, the most part, the foursomes and four balls work out. You know who to play. For instance, at Whistling Straits, you didn't need to think hard to say John Rahm's going to play with Sergio or somebody like that, or Rory is going to play with Shane Lowry or something like that. You know, it doesn't take a lot of working out. But it's... And of course, that's the way you practice too. You practice in your matches. Hopefully, you play in the same football.
You still
football.
Have to be prepared to change. I mean,
you've got
to know when to abandon.
You have to have an open mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. You really do have to have an open mind. Whatever you think of doesn't work, you have to change it right away.
Yeah.
For instance, at Kiwa Island, I thought Nick Faldo and Ian Woosnam were a wonderful partnership. Ian Woosnam was the world's number one. Nick was the world's number two. They had played well in 87 together. They were unbeatable, I think, at Muirfield Village. Yeah. It was an inspired choice by Tony. It didn't work out.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't work out at all.
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe it. Two great players like this. And I thought to myself, okay, they've lost the first two, but if they keep playing, they'll win. But they never gave me the chance to keep playing because they both decided that it wasn't working. And so I put Ian Woosnam with his best friend Paul Broadhurst. And that worked a treat. Yeah. They won. And that was because they were friends.
Yeah.
They were best friends.
Mm. He was the best guy for Broadhurst, I would have thought. That.
Yeah. I mean, but they know each other. It worked a treat. One was a great player. One was a rookie. One was experienced. One wanted to be helped nursed through it.
Yeah.
And Paul Broadhurst, great short game, hole a putt for you. Ian Woosnam, great long game, you know.
Mm.
Seemed to...
Yeah, yeah, it's... Yeah, it's just, not an exact science, it's funny how it all works.
It took me 2 matches to work it out.
Yeah.
That was the problem.
But it's become such a science now. I mean, they've got all the stats. I think it's too much.
Yeah,
you've got to go with your guts.
Eduardo Molinari, I was trying to read some of these stats and I don't really know how to work it out. But it's now. I just like to know, I've had 29 putts going round. I knew that when I played, I couldn't win a tournament unless I had 29 putts around.
Right.
And now it's shots gained on the green, and shots through the green gained, and all the rest of it, and this and that. And I just think, you know, if Bernard Langer and Padraig Harrington have a whole season where they average 28 putts, that's phenomenal, which they have done. Mm-hmm. Now I've got to work it out, holes, putts gained in, over this.
Yeah.
And I've got the guy whose book it is upstairs, and I can't make head nor tail of the book. It's a, like a mathematical problem.
Yeah.
But
not my strong point.
No, it's not my strong point either. No.
anyway, I want to finish up, Bernard, with just two or three questions on getting back to more about you rather than just the Ryder Cup.
Okay.
I was aware that you didn't play much in the majors in America, but I didn't realise it was one Masters and that's it. You never played in the US Open or the PGA.
Well, the US never gave you an invitation, even when you played in the Ryder Cup, even when you won the Order of Merit, even when you finished third, fourth, fifth, sixth, you never got into it. So that's been one of the big advances that, first of all, Ken Schofield had done, and it was done through the World Golf Rankings.
Yeah.
The Masters I played in 1970 after I'd won.
What did you make of that?
I was frankly disappointed. You know, a great place, obviously. It's nice, course is beautiful condition. It was like a garden party.
Yeah.
There was only 50 players in the field. It was like an American exhibition match.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah.
And
the greens were a lot slower then, as well.
The greens were a lot slower, but they were quite quick compared to what I was used to, but very slopey.
Yeah.
Wide open off the tee, very slopey. Mm-hmm. But it was like it was an occasion. You know, they had these dinners, international dinner, mm-hmm. and had a dinner for the past captain, past winners, then this. The highlight for me was Bobby Jones shaking his hand. Because he was in a wheelchair and he met everybody going through the ninth. Mm-hmm. He was sitting.
Well, he died at the end of 71. So
there you go. So he was sitting at the green and behind the ninth green. It was sad to see him, to be honest. But that was, to me, was a highlight of the visit.
Yeah, I mean, I've argued that guys slightly younger than you, the sort of Mark James, Sam, you know, Ken Brown, you know, that kind of group, who were kind of one step down from the stars of the European team.
Yeah,
they got screwed in terms of, and you would come under that heading as well, in terms of getting into majors. I mean, Seve won his first Masters, he was playing in that Masters because he was in the top one of the Open the year before.
Top one, exactly.
So, you know.
Yeah, so I got in the Masters, but there was no regulation to get you in the Masters. I got an invitation because I was number one in Europe, or Britain, or wherever you want to call it. The US Open was always a tricky one because they sent me an entry. When I won the Order of Merit and was third, they sent me an entry form for a pre-qualifying somewhere in America. And the US PGA was always a difficult one because in the past I've always said that really shouldn't be a major. Mm. And the reason I say that is because 40% of the field were club pros. And so, and even Raymond Floyd said somewhere that he said, well, it's difficult to consider a major when there's so many good players not able to play in it.
Yeah.
And so that always felt to me under diminished early on because it was club pros and touring pros. And so there was no room for international players to play because the main PGA Tour player wasn't getting in it either.
Yeah,
and so for me it was always a case of I never really considered it a major. It's developed into a major, but in some ways I don't really know a lot of difference between the US Open and the US PGA, to be honest, because there's almost the same criteria, and you know nowadays the courses are just the same, and so what's the difference? You can tell the difference between the Masters, for instance, and the British Open on a seaside course.
Yeah.
And the Masters is this made for television.
Mm-hmm.
It's still an invitational 80-man field. We know all the courses. We know the beautiful blue water and the azaleas and the rhododendrons. We see all that. But then we go to the US Open. You never know what the US Open. One minute they want to be on a seaside course. The next minute they're playing on Oakmont.
Mm.
On inland coast with fast greens, and I never know. Yeah, then they're going to be in Shinnecock, they're trying to be seaside again, and then they're going to be inland again. Whereas the US PGA is quite similarly They know their courses.
Yeah. But I've always argued that the list of winners, major championship winners, you can only really start to take it seriously in the last 35, 40 years. Because before that, it was just, it's just America. They were the only, they were the ones that got to play. Exactly.
I never, I never felt very welcome in America.
No, I'm sure you didn't.
Growing up, especially in the 70s.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that in a bad way. I just think the American pros are is for the Americans. I just, I'm quite happy to let them, you know, play themselves and I'll play over here.
Yeah.
But now the money's got so different, and of course, a lot of our players come through the college systems that now they want them to play, you know, that it's competitive. TV want an international field.
Yeah.
I mean, in some ways, TV are demanding a Ryder Cup every week in America.
Yeah.
So that they can see it, and you can see the billboard. You can say, these are Americans, and these are the international field in this one. It's like a Ryder Cup, you know.
It wasn't that long ago that the World Golf Hall of Fame had an international section.
Yeah, there you
Think about that.
Yeah.
You know, it's nonsense.
So from a marketing point of view, it's been successful from Americans because it's driven by the TV. Then the TV can go and sell their pictures around the world to whoever.
I tell you what did surprise me. I was a wee bit surprised at what I just said about you playing one Masters and nothing else. What did surprise me was that you were never in the top 10 in the Open.
No.
You must look back on that and think,
well, I do, I had a couple of chances, you know, of doing quite well. But looking back, you know, I was always playing the wrong courses in the lead up to the Open. We couldn't really afford to take the week off before the Open, and before the Open was the French Open, and I'm not trying to make excuses here, but it was a time when Jack Nicklaus and Tom Watson are coming over and are spending a week before the Open playing on a seaside course in windy conditions, getting used to it. You know, I never really played much on seaside. Although I come from Scotland, I didn't come from seaside Scotland.
No.
Bathgate's inland is where anywhere can be, and my other club is Dalmahoy.
Yeah.
So it's like a parkland course.
Yeah.
And so I never really got, and there weren't many tournaments on the British Tour and European Tour in those days at the seaside. It was like considered to be like sanctuary off the Open Championship. And so, looking back, and I've said this quite recently, I should have taken the week off before the Open and played courses near the Open and get used to the wind.
Yeah.
Because you get used to playing in a wind, you know, you get used to it buffeting you,
well, I mean,
especially on the greens and things like that, and the way they're shaped.
Yeah.
But the best I ever played, I thought I was going well at Royal Troon 1 year, then I took a six at the 17th. Which was a par three hole. I hit a two iron. I just came off a little bit to the left, went away into this thick rough, and I ended up still having a 69 with a six at the 17. Wow. And I think I finished 12th that year. Maybe I forgot who maybe won it.
I remember on Ewan Murray on this podcast, when his dad was the pro at Babberton in Edinburgh, and he said his dad used to put him on the train to Dunbarn and say, "Get down there and learn how to play golf." You know, you would get off the train and walk down to the golf course and play Dunbar. He was a member at Dunbar.
Oh, right.
And that would have been the perfect grounding for some, you know.
Yeah, it was, yeah. Well, that's right, because he was at Babberton. It was an inland course.
Yes.
So that helped him experience the seaside conditions, yeah. I mean, talking about Ewan Murray's dad, I mean, Ewan Murray's dad, Jimmy Murray, he was a good club maker. And when I was an amateur, he used to help reface my drivers. And when I turned pro, I was still using a driver that Jimmy Murray had really built for me when I turned pro, and I drove it well.
Yeah. The very last question, Bernard.
Yeah.
Inevitably, we have to talk a little bit about where golf is at the moment, or pro golf. It's a bit chaotic, a bit of a mess, however way you want to put it, with the live and they're all talking about it at the moment. I mean, where do you think they're headed, and where would you like to see them headed?
Well, if you read what they say in the papers, they're headed for a conciliation, and they're talking about 2025 being the time where they're going to have these specialist tournaments that's between the Saudi money are going to put in, so they can have these 15 tournaments or something, play about 12 on the American tour, then the balance played throughout the world for the elite players.
Do you like that?
Well, you know, it's money, you know, it's all about money. I just feel Jay Moynihan, and he's the nicest guy in the world, Jay Moynihan. I mean, you would want to go out for dinner with him. you couldn't meet a nicer person. I've only met him a couple of times, and I thought, this is a really nice guy. I think he should have spoken to Greg Norman early on, when Greg came up with this plan. It's a type of dismissal that Dean Beaman would have done and Tim Fincham would have said. But we're in different times now, and there's more money behind, there's more money involved. I just think there was nothing wrong with sitting down with Greg Norman and seeing what he... Because I don't believe for one moment that Greg Norman wanted to take over the PGA Tour. I think he wanted to be part of the PGA Tour, and he wanted to be part of world golf with his ideas on... He did not want to take it over. And I think the PGA Tour thought, oh, he wants to take it over. We're not going to speak to him. And it's taken all this acrimony and Rory saying what he has. It's got deeply personal.
Yeah.
The funny thing was, Greg Norman hasn't really said anything.
Not for a while, no.
No, but anything. And he's had all this stuff blasting at him personally and this and that. And Rory's pleased that he's beaten his record and all the rest. And Rory's never going to play. And Rory's been put up to this because he's the player's representative on the board of the PGA. And then there's been a real turnaround. I mean, I feel sorry in a way for Rory McIlroy.
Well, he was kind of the legs taken out from under him, to be honest.
Yes, I know. Yes, he has. But, you know, so let's get over that. I'm just disappointed that it's taken so long to speak, because there's going to be a big benefit for world golf here when they get together. It's going to be a big opportunity for a lot of our players. But they've got to find a more equitable world golf ranking.
Oh, well, that,
so that our players, you can't have that McGibbon winning the Porsche Open, which is a big tournament in Europe, and it was against the Memorial Tournament in America, and he's getting 16 points for winning that, and Victor Hovland, who won the Memorial, got 67 points. We know the money's different in America, and we know they've got strength of field. But that's not equitable in terms of world golf.
Yeah.
So our players, going by that formula, we're never going to get in a major again.
No, that's right. It'd be very difficult to get in the top 50 in the world playing in Europe.
Yeah, and so we shouldn't really be talking about these majors and opportunities, because the world golf rankings has to be better balanced.
Yeah, well, I've written this already, so I'm not giving anything away. I think just get rid of them.
Yeah.
We managed fine before they came along. The majors managed to make up.
Actually, the World Golf Rankings were brought in by Mark McCormack to get the Americans into the British Open, as we know.
Yeah.
Because there were players like Tom Kite were falling out the top 20, and the Open champions still wanted them in. And so we didn't want them to fall out the top 20 for 2 years, not 1 year. So they would have to have changed this.
But I think if they can't come up with an equitable system, and it's a ridiculous notion to think that if you're playing in America and I'm playing in Europe, that how can we possibly be compared? Because we're playing on different courses, on different days, in different weather, at different times, in different blah, 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 blah. On it goes. What is the point?
Well, there's too much emphasis, as well as that, there's too much emphasis on the money and strength of field. Because the way things happen, it's only going to be one way.
Yeah, yeah.
And,
so I think just get rid of them. And the majors can do what they want, because they managed fine before. You know.
Let's have a European order of merit, bang, straight down, top 20, and you go.
There you go.
There you go.
Yeah,
America have the same. They have their top 20 and you go
into
the US Open.
Yeah. I think they should just put us in charge, Bernard. It would probably be a better place.
I don't think that's going to happen.
No, I don't think so either. And on that note, I must thank you for your time.
Okay.
It's been a pleasure for me to listen to you and talk to you. It's something I've wanted to do for a long time.
Very nice. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
What a marvellously understated attitude for someone who has achieved so much in the game. And I've got to say, some genuinely good and new stories have been added to the fabric that makes up the Ryder Cup. Thank you very much to Bernard Gallagher for taking some time to chat with Huggy. Well, from one critical player and captain to another, when Huggy catches up next week with the one and only Sam Torrance.
I was crying my eyes out going down the fairway, but I had to held myself together. And then, of course... You're right. He gave me my moment. I had three putts to win from 25 feet, probably. And
How much did that do for your kind of public profile, if you like?
Well, I haven't brought a drink since.
Right, yeah.
That's next time on The Thing About Golf.